ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There are many ways to travel around this vast country. Plane is the quickest, of course. Lots of people love a road trip. One of my brothers did it by bicycle. But so far, there are only five people who have paddled their way around the whole of Australia. Bonnie Hancock took on sharks, crocodiles, sea snakes, sunburn, 6 metre swells, an incredibly sore bum, and unrelenting seasickness in her quest to be the youngest and the fastest person to circumnavigate Australia on a surf ski. It was a gruelling 12,700-kilometre journey, one that Bonnie had to make in her own head as well as with her body, and one which was only possible through the support of a dedicated crew, including her husband, a family of sailing Kiwis, and two gold prospectors with their fishing boat, Good Vibes. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Sarah. It's so lovely to be on here with you.
It is lovely and quite astonishing to have you here. I'm glad you're here on dry land next to me. Bonnie, a lot of us tried new stuff during COVID, you know, whether it was baking sourdough or maybe knitting. How did COVID lead you to this idea of paddling around Australia?
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. We've got to take ourselves back to those years, right? Mid-2020 was when I picked up a book, which turned out to be quite a fateful sort of day. Just like any day during COVID, we were coming in and out of lockdowns. There was still no toilet paper on the shelves whatsoever. And I went to my local library. I love reading. It's part of, I guess, that important part of being an athlete. You want to switch off, and reading helps me do that. And I went to my library, I picked up three books, and as part of that pile was a book called Fearless. It was about Freya Hoffmeister, the German woman who paddled around Australia in 2009. And I'd never heard of her story. Somehow it didn't quite make it into the mainstream media. And she broke the record. She beat the blokes who had the records prior, and she did it in 10 and a half months. I got about a chapter into this book. I was reading about sharks and crocodiles stalking Freya for up to 100 kilometres, but it was like a gut feeling, like this is something I have to do. Not that I even want to do, I have to do this. And whether it was that craving for adventure, I'm not sure. But, you know, in December of 2021, I took that idea. I set foot on that line at the Mermaid Beach, and I turned right. I paddled out and turned right.
Well, that gut feeling, that push to achieve something, you first had that as a kid around being an Iron Woman. How did you chase that goal, that earlier athletic goal?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm third in line of four girls. I've been competitive since a very young age. I remember when my older sisters could shoot three-pointers on the basketball court. I remember this day we had a basketball court in our backyard, and I stood out there all afternoon throwing this ball at this hoop as it started to get dark, and mum's calling me inside, and I would not go in until I could do that. I just wanted to do what my older sisters were doing. At the age of 12, I have a really specific memory of sitting in the lounge room with my sister Courtney watching Carla Gilbert, the, you know, famous Iron Woman, run around on the TV. And it was just a thought, I want to be like Carla. That's what I want to do. And to do that, I'm probably going to have to move out of Coffs Harbour, our tiny little, town of Sawtelle within Coffs Harbour. And I've got to go to the Gold Coast to do that. That's what I thought.
And so when did you make that move? How old were you?
I was 17 when I moved out of home. I packed up my little car. Courtney did too. And we moved to the Gold Coast. So 17 and 18, I didn't know how to cook a single meal. I had to call mum and ask what products to clean the bench down with. We moved into a share house of athletes. And after around 5 months of training, we both made it into the professional Iron Woman series. So it was everything we ever wanted. Yeah.
So, I mean, the term, the name Iron Woman gives a sense of the kind of level required. What are the events involved in becoming an Iron Woman?
Absolutely. So Iron Woman racing, different to Ironman triathlon, like Kona, the long distance, this is surf Iron Woman racing. So not only are you taking on 19 other competitors on the line, you're taking on Mother Nature in the ocean. It's a mix between ski, swim, board and run. I guess you'd explain the ski like a kayak, but a little bit heavier. It's 18 kilos. They're not easy to manoeuvre in and out of the surf. You are running on soft sand, which is one of, I think, the hardest surface to run on. You're not just swimming like in a pool, but you're going under waves that can be 8 foot sometimes. And the board is similar to a paddling position like on a surfboard, but you also can paddle it on your knees. So it's a mix of everything. We were training 3 times a day to make sure we were physically conditioned to race in these events.
So you were giving it everything, you and your older sister, Courtney. Did you achieve what you wanted as an Iron Woman, Bonnie?
Yes and no, I think as athletes, we're so hard on ourselves, and there's always parts of my career I look back and say, oh, if I would have gone 5 metres to the left that day, I would have made it over that wave and I would have won that race. Courtney had an incredibly successful career as an Ironwoman. She's won every title there is to win, the Australian title, Coolangatta Gold. I was pretty happy, I think, making the podium most of the times. These girls are the best in the world. There was probably a period of time around my mid-20s that I started to get really frustrated with coming second. I had so many seconds and near wins. I got to this stage where I thought, right, the quickest way to get there is to squeeze some extra sessions in, which is ridiculous, around 3 a day. I was at uni at the time. I started kind of sneaking extra sessions in. I'd go to the gym in my free time. And I started probably isolating myself a little from friends and family more and more and thought, this is what I've got to do. I became more anxious and I started to feel quite low, but I didn't pick up those sort of red flags. It didn't end that well for me. I ended up quite sick. I got glandular fever. I actually had to have 2 years out of the sport. So everything I'd ever known and loved, and it really my identity was wrapped up in who I was as an Iron Woman. But that 2 years ended up being the best thing that could have happened for me. I found out who I was outside of just an Iron Woman and on the water. It made me a whole person. And when I came back, I actually put my foot on the line in an Ironwoman race against all of those Iron Women, and I had the biggest race win of my career. So go figure, right? We find out who we are, what we love, what we're good at, what our interests are, other than just being an athlete. Happy athlete is a dangerous athlete.
After that time away, you refocused on surf ski eventually. What's a surf ski look like? How does it compare to a kayak, say?
Yeah, it is such a good point. I need to remind myself to explain things in layman's terms because it is quite a niche sport that we do. So like anyone, I guess, who's paddled a kayak on the flat water, you've got your beginner sort of heavier craft, I guess, that are probably the old skis are around 20 kilos plus. They're easy to paddle. Our really lightweight surf life saving skis are 18 kilos. So there's not a whole lot of weight in them to take on these huge waves and you know, the big surf. But then you look at an ocean ski, that's different again. 8 kilos, it's made purely of carbon fiber. These are built for, you know, 20-kilometre races out in the middle of the ocean. There's the most famous race is the Molokai, which is over in Hawaii, and it's 50 kilometres. So you're way offshore. You're paddling this tiny little craft, but I can tell you they go very fast. They go up to probably 30 kilometres an hour, and when the wind and the waves are behind you, you just sit back and surf these things all day. So there's the surf life-saving skis, and the ocean ski is almost like an offshoot of that sport.
And how do you control them? How do you manoeuvre them, Bonnie? Is it just with the paddle?
So you actually have pedals. So the pedals control a rudder in the back, so a fin. And yeah, left pedal down, it goes left. Right pedal down, it goes right. When you have a huge wave in front of you and you need to back paddle, you need to think opposite to that with the steering. And also your paddle, it's a good point you make, helps you control it as well. So particularly when you're coming down a wave and, you know, your rudder might be out of the water, that paddle can be a really useful way of steering. So These craft, I mean, they were first developed, I think maybe Hawaii, I don't want to quote that, but the Hawaiians have been paddling them for centuries, and they've just evolved into the really advanced craft where they're at now.
So you'd spent a lot of time in the ocean and you knew that you had the ability to push your body really hard. But was there a part of you that was, you know, after the excitement of reading this book about the woman who'd paddled around Australia, was there a part of you that thought, actually, maybe this is too big for me to take on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I actually, upon initially conceiving the idea, I then went back and forth for 6 months. I thought, I wrote myself a list of why and why nots. The why nots was pages long. You know, a third of our coastline is inhabited by saltwater crocodiles.
It's really big why not.
Right. It's just crazy to think about paddling an 8-kilo ski amongst that. You know, these things, the big ones are over 6 meters. That's the length of my ski. My ski's 45 centimeters across. So you can just sort of fit your hips into them. Great white sharks, you know, these scary challenges. I wrote this list. I got 6 months in of going back and forth. My mind was a mess and I decided not to do it. I actually said, it's too much. It's going to be an exorbitant amount of money we've got to come up with. My husband and I had just bought a house. We had minimal savings and I thought it's too much. And that very day that I thought it's too much, I'm not going to do it, I had a premonition. I imagined myself as an 80-year-old woman sitting there in my rocking chair, not having done it. And I immediately felt sick with regret because I never would have known where I would have got to. Would I have got a week in and have to turn around? Would I have been able to complete it? And so it was that fear of regret that actually got me to the start line. And I think as well, being okay with the idea of failing, because there was every chance that I was going to fail this. And all of those experiences I'd had in my 20s and not putting my self-worth in results actually prepared me to put a foot on the line and be like, it's okay if I fail this. It doesn't make me any less of a human.
So you disregarded the why not column. You went with the why column and, yes. And you did all that hard work of getting sponsors and a crew and a boat and set off from the Gold Coast. Mm-hmm. And you say that when you paddled out, you turned right.
Yeah.
Why right, not left?
That's a great question too, because everyone before me had turned left. The four who had been successful, there were multiple others who tried and like we said, it was the crocodiles that stopped them in the Northern Territory. They'd all gone left to follow the currents around Australia. I didn't know anything about currents until this. As Iron Women, we paddle maybe 500 metres offshore max. I was looking at paddling hundreds of kilometres out to sea. So I thought, I've got to talk to the experts. I reached out through about 10 degrees of separation. I was put on to Sir Roger Batten. He's one of the world's leading meteorologists. He advises the super yacht captains, the sailors at the Olympics. And he said, go clockwise. There's the East Australian current, which runs from the Great Barrier Reef down to Tasmania. It pushes the warm water down. He said, that'll give you a head start. It's going to give you an advantage. It's actually the current off Finding Nemo that the little turtles get in, if that sounds familiar to anyone. And it did. By the time I got to Sydney, I was a week ahead of the record. So it was following the East Australian current.
Could you feel that water under your ski?
Yeah, absolutely. So as athletes, we talk about ease of paddling and it felt easy. You know, I had the wind behind me. There were northerlies, thank goodness. And my body was still conditioning at this stage. You know, the furthest I'd paddled leading in was 20 kilometres in these sessions. I didn't want to go in with niggles. So I knew it was important to actually have the assistance of the ocean while my body was conditioning to paddling over 100K a day most days. And that East Australian current helped. The paddling felt easy.
As you began logging those long days on the surf ski, I mean, this might sound like a weird question, Bonnie, but were you lonely?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was the two parts of it. It was at the start, physically, that was the biggest challenge. And when I say easy paddling, I don't mean it was easy all the time. I mean, there were times where I couldn't lift my paddle above my belly button. I couldn't move and talk at the end of the day. But the loneliness was the biggest challenge. Being in the water for 16 hours a day, not being able to come in towards my crew, you know, sometimes the boat, I had a 38-foot catamaran supporting me, showing me where to go, but I couldn't get within 100 metres of them a lot of the days because it was too dangerous. That boat's 10 ton. It was just the constant mind games I had to play. It was having the devil and the angel on the shoulder and the devil saying, I don't think you can do this. You've bitten off more than you can chew. You've gotten all of these people invested. You've only ever been a sprint Iron Woman. What evidence do you have to suggest you can do this thing? And it was the other side saying, I know all of that, but if I can find a way to keep moving forward, even if that's slowly and painfully, maybe I can get this done.
And what sort of things were you doing practically to keep yourself alert and interested in those hours and hours at sea alone?
Music was absolutely crucial on this. And I know music means a lot to a lot of people. And so many of our really beautiful memories and, you know, childhood memories that kind of, you can associate certain songs. It kind of like just sentimental. It's the same with me for this paddle. When I hear certain songs, it takes me back to a certain time in the paddle. Rap music was my go-to choice because that, you know, fast tempo. I love, as I said, writing and words. So the lyrics is what that keeps me engaged. There were certain times where my crewmate Jamie would load up my headphones with a playlist of house music, you know, no lyrics all day, if that's what I was feeling. So it was kind of leaning into what I was feeling that day. And sometimes, as I say, it was the dulcet tones of Vance Joy that would keep me company all day. And in the scary, scary waters, sometimes that beautiful calming music, that's what I actually put on. But most of the time it was quite hardcore.
Hardcore rap.
Yes, exactly.
You beefed up. Was your body adapting in the way that you hoped it would? You said you didn't want to go in with niggles. You deliberately were in over your usual weight, knowing that this strain that these hours would do. What was happening with you physically in those first few weeks?
Yeah, it was such an interesting time. I actually put 15 kilos on leading in the 6 months. I knew as a dietitian I wouldn't be able to meet the 6,000 calories plus required. I also knew the water's freezing at the bottom of the country. It's 9 degrees in the middle of the Great Australian Bight. And if I went into that underweight, there was a very real risk of getting hypothermia. So for 6 months, I ate plenty of croissants, donuts. I was having double my portion sizes at lunch. It was like something off Bridget Jones's Diary. It was, you know, I almost felt like an actor preparing for a role and shifting my mindset, taking away that vanity, knowing that was part of my performance. That actually saved me when it did come to the cold waters. But by the same token, it was uncomfortable sitting in my ski. I had a lot of swelling throughout my whole body, so inflammation. And the worst thing was because I was so seasick, I couldn't keep those tablets down. So I had bulging discs in my back from a couple of months in. So those first couple of weeks, it was almost like the novelty was still there. But once that wore off, things felt more painful, away from the flashes of the cameras and all of that stuff. But we had to start.
So seasickness, Bonnie. Were you actually seasick on the surf ski?
Yeah, absolutely.
As you were paddling?
As I was paddling. So to paint a bit of a picture, and sorry if anyone's having their lunch, I would paddle, you know, from a week in, I was paddling over 100K a day. And once we started to move away from the civilised section of coastline of New South Wales, I would say once we got past the south coast of New South Wales, we started heading a long way out to sea. When you look at the map of Australia, it's far from a perfect circle. So you want to cut from point to point. You don't want to follow the coast. It's 22,000 kilometres when you follow the coast. I did this in 12,700 kilometres, but I had to be prepared to go out to sea. So that's no land in sight out there. And I would be projectile vomiting over the side of my ski as my crewmates looked on from the boat. They would sort of have sympathy or empathy and start vomiting as well. And it was just an awful, ugly picture, but everything was coming up. So I was losing weight quite drastically and I pretty much lost the 15 kilos by the time I got to the bottom of the country. I never knew I got that seasick because I'd never been that far out in the ocean on a ski. But at the start, it was just on the boat. I was getting sick. The ski was like my happy place. Sure enough, it started in the ski.
So when you were sleeping at night on the boat after, you know, 100 Ks of surf skiing and projectile vomiting, what were things like for you and your tummy on the boat at night?
Yeah, honestly, once everything was out of my stomach, it was often better. And it sounds disgusting, but sometimes it was just acid that was coming up, acid reflux. Once it got to that stage, it was actually a little bit better. And sometimes all I could do when I came onto the boat was actually lay out on the back deck of the boat because that's the most stable part of a boat, of a catamaran. So actually at the front of the boat, that was the worst. And the worst place you can go is down into the galley, down into the kitchen, because that's where the heat is. So you want to keep cool and you want to stay out on the back deck. So while I was laying flat down on the back deck, asking my crewmates to get a bunch of different things for me, a blanket to keep me warm, maybe a cup of, you know, hot chocolate. That's when I was what I would call that was my safe place. Other than that, everywhere else, it was just, it was on for young and old with the vomiting.
Those huge swells that were bringing you seasickness, did they also get you, push you out of the surf ski? Were you falling out?
Multiple times a day. There were times I was falling out of my ski up to 10 times a day. And you've got to remember as well, with these tailwinds, the boats moving, the catamarans moving so quickly. There was a time down in Victoria where the boat was sailing at 13 kilometres an hour with the sails down, so they couldn't go any slower. So I've got to go with the boat, you know, out in the middle of the ocean. I was falling out and the boat was taking 500 metres to come back. So, you know, for 10 minutes, I'm waiting for this boat to turn around. And a part I often forget to mention is a lot of this paddle was done at night.
Why at night?
There were certain reasons. You want to work with Mother Nature, with the wind. So you want to paddle when that wind's behind you. So we would be looking at the forecast. You know, the skipper would be analysing the week ahead and what was coming. So as I was making my way down the East Coast, we want northerlies behind me. So if the wind's picking up at 12 o'clock in the day, there's not really any point paddling before that. If I go at 12 and paddle till 12 that night, I'm going to get the best conditions. It's easier paddling. I'm going further.
So did you have a light on your ski, or how could you see where you were going?
I had a little head torch. I had an LED light on the back of the boat, but that's all. So that's up to 500K out to sea. And that light was flashing on the back of my boat and on my ski. And essentially it saved my life a couple of times, because the boat would have to come back to me and make sure I was okay, either whether I got on or not. But that flashing light essentially saved my life.
How tricky was it to pull yourself back in once you tipped out of a surf ski?
It's like doing a chin-up. That's probably how hard it is. So you've got your ski. They're honestly probably harder, a weighted chin-up. That ski is getting tossed and turned around in these waves. You're trying to hold it at the direct angle you need against the swells so you can get on, because if that ski is, say, facing with the swells, it's just going to roll away from you. I'm also strapped to it. We usually use leg ropes as ski paddles, similar to what you use on a surfboard. The only thing that would hold in these 25, 30 knot winds was what the sailors use, a safety line and carabiner, what Jess Watson in her movie used to clip herself to the side of the boat. So I'd have to get the ski on the perfect angle, do a chin up type movement to get in. And this was often in freezing cold, so you're shaking all over, and it would take me 6-7 times to get in sometimes.
Bonnie, when you could bring yourself to look around and when there was a light for you to be able to take in the scenery, what was the coastline like as you rounded that southeast corner of Australia?
Incredible, amazing, fascinating. I had learnt by that stage that the best way I was going to get through this paddle, being in so much pain, my body screaming out, having to keep going, was to actually take in my surroundings. And it took until the bottom of the country to actually do that. I was in this tunnel vision focus, typical athlete, for the first, you know, stretch all the way to Sydney and past. By the time I got to Victoria, we were paddling past places where it looked like something off Lord of the Rings, these rolling green hills with no one around for 100 kilometres or so. Wilson's Prom at the very bottom of the country, for those who've been there, it's like something off a movie. And I would say to my crew, remind me to look right. Remind me to look right and take in the surroundings. This is when we were close enough to shore to do so. And that was when I physically started feeling better. That was when mentally I would be more positive, and there was always a positive to take in. Even in the middle of the night, paddling in the dark, if I looked up and there were stars up there, I'd think, how special is this? I'm the only person in the world who has this perspective of the, you know, the sky right now. So I think those silver linings were so important.
You managed to see the 12 apostles from a unique vantage point. How close did you get to those?
Honestly, I got within a couple of hundred metres from those, what I call statues of the sea. And looking up at them from that perspective, it's just a feeling of overwhelming awe. And my catamaran couldn't come that far in. They were about a K out. So I actually had to leave my catamaran. And it's an area that is sort of known for some sharks, and it's cold water. So, but I felt so brave in that moment, and it was so worth it. I paddled away from my boat and I just sat there and took in that moment, and I could see some tourists up on the cliffs looking down, And I'm sure they could see me, and a chopper went overhead. It was a Surf Life Saving Victoria chopper. And it almost felt like in that moment I was sharing that with these people from all different perspectives. But from a ski, to be looking at those statues of the sea, it's something right now I'm taking myself back to that moment so clearly, because there was so much emotion or attached.
Mm-hmm. There were animals that you were keen to avoid, and we'll get to some of those. But what were some of the ones you were happy to see?
Oh, I tell you, the seals, they are the most cheeky animal on earth, I think. They would pop up, you know, once we started getting to the cooler waters of Victoria and South Australia where they hang out. I would be paddling in the middle of a day and just have a seal head pop up next to me. And they actually get frightened of humans too, which is hilarious. So at the end of each day, if there were dolphins in the water, my crew and I would jump out and pop, you know, the scuba goggles on and go have a look. This, again, it took me a couple of months to actually participate in these activities with my crew. I thought for the first 2 months, I can't do that. I've got to be an athlete. I've got to just get straight on the boat, put the compression boots on and recover. But I started realizing I was missing all these amazing opportunities. And there was a time in Victoria where I dove into the water with those goggles. And instead of a dolphin popping up, it was a seal. I came face to face with this seal. I remember its big look of surprise, and it basically swam away as quickly as it could. So in waters where I was feeling scared, this seal was on edge too. And it's not surprising, knowing the predators they've got.
To try to do this feat in as fast a time as possible, you weren't going to hug the coastline. There were going to be places that you went from point to point.
Yeah.
And one of those was across the Great Australian Bight.
Mm-hmm.
What did people experienced with that stretch of ocean think about your plan?
They thought I was crazy. I had that multiple times, probably over 50 times leading in. I was told by skippers and these super yacht captains I was speaking to and marine pilots that that's crazy. You don't go east to west across the Bight. We all know that most of the time the currents and the wind is running west to east. But I'd spoken to Sir Roger Batten, and he said, you'll get a weather window. You might have to wait a few days for it, maybe even a week, but you'll get that weather window across the Bight. And we did. We waited 2 days at a place ominously called Coffin Bay, which was the last point of mainland contact in South Australia before we did the Bight crossing. And the place just before Coffin Bay was Misery Bay. So someone had named this apparently after they'd crossed the Bight. That's where we started from. And I was facing a 1,200 kilometre crossing on a ski. It had actually never been done in history. So there was no blueprint. We actually didn't know if it physically could be done.
So once you had a weather window and the catamaran dropped you and your surf ski out 500 kilometres or so from the shore, what was it like? What could you hear? Are there any sea animals around you that you can see?
It was so quiet. It's just quiet out there. And I remember I would often take my headphones off and just listen. And you realise the pace of life that far out to sea is so slow. And, you know, when I came back, it took me a few months to get used to the pace of life on land again. All there was out there for that 2 weeks was albatross birds and mutton birds. And what I thought was fascinating is that the mutton birds return to shore every evening. They fly at 80 kilometres an hour to do that. The albatross float on the wind for months at a time. And I had these situations where the albatross were very interested in me, because they'd obviously seen no crazy person on a ski out there, and they would come within touching distance. And I remember reaching out and touching an albatross. It put its wing out, sitting on the water, and just crazy stuff like that. But other than that, it's just the wind and the swell. So a squawk of a bird gives you a big fright.
What was it like paddling when the wind was behind you down there in the Southern Ocean?
It's what every ski paddler trains their whole life for, those conditions. It's amazing. It's incredible. It's, you feel strong and powerful, and just the utmost sense of freedom as well. I remember leaning back as I reached a top speed of 28K an hour without even paddling, cruising for 500 metres without putting my paddle in the water, and just letting Mother Nature do the work and just feeling completely free and in a way that I hadn't since I was a child. And, you know, the water is freezing out there. Again, it's under 10 degrees. The only thing that kept me warm was a thick steam wetsuit, which had a hood. It had booties. It had gloves. So I'm completely covered head to toe. I've got fluoro gear on to keep me safe, make sure my crew can see me. But at nighttime, that feeling of freedom becomes fear, because you don't want the big wind and the swells when it's pitch black dark.
You know, the way you're describing it, it sounds pretty idyllic, this part, Bonnie. But what happened on day 8 of your crossing of the Great Australian Bight?
Yeah, absolutely. Something really scary happened. So I basically was about halfway across the bight, and it was at night time. There was actually no moon out that day. So as we know, the moon cycle, every now and then you get no moon. Incredibly dark. I can't see other than maybe half a metre either side of my ski. The wind was just absolutely pumping. It was over 25 knots. This is so strong. And I fell out of my ski. And as I said, the wind was really, really strong. My support boat couldn't stop that quickly. They had the sails up. So they sailed away from me. So I'm in the water. I was at the end of a 100 kilometre day. I'd had no food, held no food down for a week. And I'm trying to get in, doing that chin-up style movement, and I can't get in my ski. I tried 6 times, and in that process, the ski flipped up and banged me in the head. So I've sunk back down into the water. I've then kind of lost sort of my ability to know kind of what direction was I should even be going. That came back quickly. I tried to get back into my ski. I fell out again. I realized I wasn't getting into that ski.
Were you panicking?
I went into a really strange sense of calm, which was actually concerning, because when I went into that sense of calm, a feeling of warmth started to overtake my body and my extremities. And I found out later that's actually the first signs of hypothermia. I didn't know it at the time. I basically put my arms over my ski and I just laid there. And I remember looking up at the sky and I saw the beautiful Southern Cross glittering in the sky. And I thought, how amazing, how beautiful is this? I had that feeling of gratitude. And then really quickly another thought happened. You're going to die. If you don't move, your boat's not coming back. You can't see them. You've actually got to keep moving forward. You've got to swim. And so slowly but surely I pushed that ski away from me and I started to move my arms and legs, just this tiny little dog paddle. And eventually I saw the lights of the boat coming back to me. So it's 12 minutes of submersion in the bite until you're hypothermic. I ended up being in for 10.
Oh, my gosh.
And by the time I was pulled aboard the boat, I couldn't move. I couldn't speak. It took a long time to get my body temperature back up. And there's no help coming out there. You're days out of range of help. There's no helicopter coming. We were 500K out in the ocean. And this is waters known for killer whales and great white sharks. And I remember also looking down at my feet while I was there with that sense of calm and seeing a blue light. And later we think that I was concussed in seeing that, because there was no blue light out there. So really scary stuff to happen in the middle of the ocean.
Once you had made it across that bite, as you say, no one had ever done it that way before, were you elated?
Yeah, relieved, first of all. The elation came later. The first thing I did when I literally sunk my feet into the sands of Dore Island, which was this island off of the coast of New South Wales, Western Australia, beg your pardon, I sunk to my knees and I just felt so relieved. And then when I got on the boat, I gave all of my crew a big hug. But I remember going down to my cabin and locking the door, shutting the door and checking the lock. And I just sunk down and started sobbing, because it was just all of the fear and doubt and everything I'd had to overcome for 2 weeks coming out. And I hadn't felt that it was the right thing to do to let all that go in those moments of paddling across for 2 weeks, because you've got to keep yourself in a pretty neutral state of mind as an ultra endurance athlete. You can't actually let your emotions get the better of you. And so it was the first time I did that and the tears just kept coming. The next day it was the time to celebrate, and we went into the island and there were seals around. We climbed to the top of the island. It was this sunset and moonrise. And when people asked me what my favourite day of the trip was, other than finishing, it was that day on Dore Island, because it was a reward for for surviving, but surviving together and getting through it.
So you rounded the southwest tip of Australia, passing the lighthouse at Cape Naturalist and begin heading up the coast. And the Zutdorp Cliffs are an infamous stretch of coastline in West Australia. What did those cliffs mean for you on your little surf ski in the water?
Absolutely. When I first pulled up the map of Australia in planning for this paddle when I decided to do it, I'd put it on satellite mode and I went over to Western Australia and I saw a 250-kilometre stretch of limestone cliff. So that tells me one thing. There's nowhere to stop. There's nowhere you can actually go in to land there. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have to need a catamaran for this trip because initially I told my husband I'd be right to do it with just a tinny beside me, which he laughed at. But for 250K, there's nothing but sheer, you know, big steep cliff faces. And it's actually named after a Dutch East Indies trading ship that wrecked there in the 1800s. And I believe it's 1800s. And basically, it's got a lot of history, but known for being a really notorious stretch of ocean. And I had to paddle that on an 8-kilogram carbon fiber ski. So I was incredibly seasick. I wanted to do it in 48 hours. I didn't want it to last any longer. And we got across there in 2 days, but it was another really big test of our resilience.
It was along that coast that you had your first shark encounter.
Yeah.
What happened?
Absolutely. So it was a place called... near Shark Bay, actually. So
all these names
point.
Are giveaways.
All
Misery Bay, Shark Bay.
Absolutely.
You can't say you weren't warned.
Right,
Bonnie.
Right. It's, the warnings were there. I just didn't heed them. So, yeah, we were paddling, you know, Steep Point, again, notorious. It's great white shark territory. A lot of the West Australian coastline is sort of infamous for great whites. As the water gets, you know, warmer, they actually still... they're still around and they move between South Africa and Australia. They've tracked them. So big sharks. And it was the end. I was 80 kilometres into paddling, feeling really good, had my music in. My body was conditioned by this stage, so I was feeling pretty good. I was bopping along to a song and on the boat there was always someone on Bonnie watch, someone watching me, keeping me safe. And my crewmate Jamie started calling me into the boat. At first it was sort of a bit more of a relaxed gesture. And I told him... No, I've got a song playing. I thought he was coming, calling me in to eat something. I thought I'll get there in a moment. He stood up straight, started dramatically calling me into the boat, and my stomach suddenly sunk. I thought something's wrong here. And so I sprinted up to the boat. They said, get on right now. And what they'd seen was the big fin of a great white, the jagged edges and everything, like something off Jaws, come up right next to my ski, disappear and take a deep dive under. They saw the shadow and just disappear. And I'm there bopping along, telling them that I'm coming into the boat in a little bit. I've got a good song. And when I got on that boat, it made me realize how vulnerable I was because I didn't even see the shark and it was huge. So, you know, sharks will often only show themselves to you when they want to. They'll sometimes be territorial. They think it might have been a bit of a territorial thing. But I had to get back in the water in that exact same spot the next day because you got to cover every meter of coastline.
You did get back in and you made it to Exmouth, about halfway up the West Australian coast. At this point, you desperately needed a new support vessel. Your catamaran had mm-hmm. other commitments. Who came to your rescue?
So there's a beautiful little beach called Seabird in Western Australia and I was going about my day. We had the jet ski. So my husband was actually on land for 8 months towing a jet ski with Ben, my other crewmate. Jamie and Blake were on the catamaran. So we were using the jet ski because we needed to find another catamaran. We had to keep moving forward. And at a chance encounter on Seabird Beach, we ran into... probably you'd call him an Aussie larrikin. I can't think of a better description for Goaty. And, you know, I can't even think of his real name right now because I called him Goaty the whole time. He has a goatee. He wears an Akubra hat. He's a gold prospector up in the Pilbara. And his best mate, Ryan, he often goes on adventures in his 6.5-metre fishing boat. We ran into Goaty and... we had a thought later that day. We exchanged numbers because we had this great conversation about what we were doing. And we thought, why don't we give him a call?
Let's try Goaty.
Right. We'll try Goaty. I thought this is absolutely ridiculous. As if anyone can commit to this, you know, we were going to have to need help basically within a couple of days. He answered that call. And within 30 seconds, he said, yes. He said, I'm in. I'm in with my best mate, Ryan. I'm in with our fishing boat called Good Times, which is the first positive, you know, sign I'd had about something. And They kept us company for 2 weeks. We camped up the beaches of the Pilbara. This was in crocodile water infested waters, and they knew that stretch of coast like the back of their hand. So they were supposed to come into my life on that day.
You didn't realise it at the time, but they were famous. They kept getting recognised, these
Absolutely.
Two fellas. Why was that?
Aussie Gold Hunters. So being gold prospectors, the Aussie Gold Hunters, that amazing show is, follows them around in their day-to-day, work that they do. They work at night time. They work incredibly hard, It's quite an interesting life they lead. They've got to arm themselves because gold prospectors have been attacked and, they get stolen from and... So our two worlds collided in a way that was complete chance. And what's interesting as well is that Godey's very open about speaking about his mental health. He'd been through a separation. He was coming down to the beach to clear his head. He said he could have gone left to Gilderton or right to Seabird. He said he turned right, like he had a gut feeling to turn right, and he ran into us. It was kind of really cool.
So after you waved goodbye to your life-saving gold prospectors, you partnered with a different ship in Broome, a catamaran of sailing Kiwis,
yes.
who offered you a lot of warmth and a lot of advice and direction. At one point, Bonnie, you were paddling along the Kimberley coast next to them or close to their ship, and you got caught in a strong eddy, both their catamaran and your ski. What yeah. happened?
Absolutely. Eddies make me believe the Bermuda Triangle is real. So I never knew these circular currents actually existed before this paddle. Eddies, they work off of islands. They literally are strong enough to draw a catamaran into them. So at the end of a 100-kilometre day, the Kiwis are in their boat. This is nighttime. They're using torches to search out to the side of the boat for crocodiles near me. Absolutely terrifying. They'd do these spot checks and I would just shudder as I waited for that torch to stop on a spot of water. But we're going around and around for 10 minutes or so and I'm thinking, what are we doing? I'm wasting energy. And they said, stay close to the boat. The skipper called out, stay close to the boat. I thought it was because of the current. And I thought, yeah, I'm doing that. I'm following you. We broke the current. 10 minutes later, they stopped the boat and said, get on right now. They'd actually seen that crocodile again.
So there was a crocodile looking at you before you got into the eddy.
I should have mentioned that part. While we were going around and around this current, they actually did see a crocodile with that torch outside the current, basically watching me. And 10 minutes later, they saw it again. So these sorts of things are, they're risks that that you're taking when you get in the water. They didn't tell me those details when they got me on the boat because I still had to keep paddling. They told me a week later the full story. But this is waters known for that. I mean, I consider the crocodile the most dangerous predator in the world. It's been around for tens of thousands of years for a reason, right?
What other dangers were in the water as you got closer to Darwin?
Yep, there were sea snakes that I never expected. Again, I heard about them. I laughed and thought, snakes in the water, as if. These are big python-looking creatures. They're yellow with black markings. They're thick as pythons, and they coil up at you as you pass. And apparently they've got to bite you between your fingers or your toes to actually kill you because they do have venom. But I think it's about puncturing the skin. They can only puncture those really thin bits of skin. But scary. I absolutely dislike snakes, and these were in the water. So not only sharks, crocodiles, sea snakes. I also had a day speaking about sharks because my mind was on crocodiles, where a huge shark leapt out of the water. None of my crew saw it on the boat, a couple of hundred meters ahead of me, and disappeared. And the skipper, when I described it, thinks it might have been a bronze whaler. It was massive. And these are just things you think, am I in a movie right now? I couldn't make this stuff up.
What about the difference in surf skiing in the tropics when there's sort of incredible heat as opposed to down the bottom of Australia? Was that easier, the heat? I mean, you had the water around you. What was the difference?
I would say it was about equal in terms of difficulty. It was 32 degree in the water. This was up near Darwin.
Not that you want to get in with the sea snakes
right,
and the crocodiles
right.
and the bronze whalers.
Absolutely. So it feels like a bath, and those creatures, love that water. 45 degrees was the hottest day that registered up in Darwin. And this was around March, April that we were paddling. So just crazy. And for anyone who's lived in the Northern Territory, they'll be able to relate to that. it makes paddling in the day nearly impossible, you know. So I was covered from wrist to ankle with a stinger suit because you've got irukandji and box jellyfish. And we have some of the most beautiful creatures in the world. We also have some of the most dangerous. So, yeah, take your pick. It was heat stroke or the creatures or, you know.
And I can't believe I have to say this, but then the next part of the challenge was to ski across the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Yeah.
As with the Great Australian Bite, you decided that you would do this as open water for speed.
Yeah.
What made this stretch of water so hard?
This was an incredibly difficult stretch of water. I actually laughed at the challenge initially because the Great Australian Bite was 1,200K, 500 kilometres out to sea. I thought, this is 800 kilometres. We've got this. We've only got to go a couple of hundred, maybe 200K out. We've got this. We're within range of help if something happens. We got hit with the strongest southeasterly trade winds I'd had in 5 years. So that's instead of these, you know, beautiful wind and swells behind you where you're basically surfing them, this is like having a full fan in your face all day. It's gripping your paddle so tightly because if you don't, the paddle just fly out of your hands and bashing into headwinds for 16, 18 hours a day. And all I would get done in that time is 70 to 80 kilometres. So I did half of the distance for twice the amount of energy. I had bulging discs in my back by that stage. I actually couldn't straighten my fingers by that stage. So they were so swollen, I couldn't open bottle caps or fridge doors. I had to get my crew to do that because I was in so much pain. Physically, my body was falling apart.
Was this the closest you got to calling it off?
Absolutely. Yeah. We got halfway across the Gulf and I had to get bailed out. I'd fallen out of my ski. I was doing 2 kilometres an hour. So I was going 30K an hour in the bite and I was going 2 kilometres an hour. And the skipper called it. He said, we've got to get out of here. It's 30 knots. There's stainless steel chains breaking on the boat. We motored into Weipa at the top of Queensland. It took me 10 days to convince him to go back out. He said, I'm not putting my crew through that. The boat can't handle it. But eventually after 10 days, he said, we've got a little weather window. You've got a couple of days to finish this off. And to get across, I was going to have to do a new 24-hour record, a new Guinness World Record to cover that distance. I just broke down and sobbed to my crew. I didn't think it was possible.
And what happened?
I sobbed to them. I wrote myself a letter to motivate myself to get back out there. And within that letter, I actually reminded myself to be proud of everything I'd done. And I knew that even if I was to fail that next day, I'd be okay. And I could be proud with everything I'd put on the line, everything I'd gotten through, and I'd be okay. I got back out there the next day. I paddled 173 kilometres in 24 hours. I set a new Guinness World Record. And I got to land the next day and I got us to Seychelles, which is at the top of Queensland. I was in my home state. We were on the way home.
You were on the way home. You'd made your final right-hand turn of this extraordinary trip. And as you started travelling south, you were again paddling past inhabited stretches of coastline and locals started coming out to paddle with you. What was that like?
It was amazing. You know, it's like Big Brother, basically, on this trip with your boat. There's sort of 5 or 6 of you on the boat. It's the size of a large living room. We were close enough to shore. Now we were actually able to come to shore, visit communities, the beautiful Townsville community. You know, I had at sort of 50, 80 people paddling with me. There were outriggers. And just to be able to have conversations through the day, once we got through those really strong trade winds, got a bit further down the coast, it flattened out. And I had multiple communities of paddlers paddle next to me. And I hadn't had that since Western Australia. The beautiful people of Fremantle paddled with me. And it just made that whole last stretch, that last home stretch, so enjoyable and reminded me of the importance of social connection.
So tell me about that final paddle, that final wave that you caught into shore. Mm. What was that morning like for you?
Oh, it was almost overwhelming, the mixed feelings, because it was just absolute relief. And I remember even when I first saw the skyline of the Gold Coast, the day before I turned to my crew and said, is this real? Is this actually happening? I've thought about this for 8 months. And and, you know, never quite believed that I was going to do it. And I think that's part of being an athlete too. You keep yourself so accountable, you know, you never count your chickens before they hatch. And it was finally letting the monkey off the back and allowing myself to enjoy it. And even that last paddle before I came to shore, I remember this really clear memory of the sun was shining on the water and it created like this illusion of stars or diamonds. And I reached down, I ran my hand along the water and I thought, I'm grabbing these stars I've seen in the sky for so long in the Great Australian Bight. It's like I can touch the stars now. And it was that very moment that I realized I'm about to cross the line for a new world record. And that pales in comparison to everything I've learned along the way into the person that I've grown into what I've had to overcome and the beautiful people who are on shore waiting for me. So it was actually in that final stretch that I realized that while crossing the line was going to be incredibly exciting, it was really that journey aspect. And that was always what it was about, this paddle. I crossed the line. I threw my arms above my head. I squealed with delight. And I got that new world record and I came back almost in the best way possible, a really different person to the 32-year-old who had left.
Well, what's the biggest difference between the Bonnie who stepped back onto the shore on the Gold Coast and the one who set off, you know, almost a year before?
I've learnt that things don't have to be perfect to keep moving forward. I've learnt to be kind to myself and know that you don't have to feel good all the time. You can have so much self-doubt and keep moving forward and relying on the people around me, leaning on those around me. I'd never, ever done that as an Iron Woman until I learnt the lesson the hard way in my mid-20s, you know, where I had to find self-worth away from the water, when I had to find a network of people. It was learning about that importance of who we have in our corner, but also the strength we can find within ourselves in a place where we never expected, in the middle of the ocean. I was learning all of those lessons along the way.
When you think back at those months at sea, what do you miss?
I often miss the quiet and I often miss just sitting out there, whether I'm close to shore or way out to sea, just sitting there in that complete freedom and clarity that you have and appreciation. But I also try to bring that into daily life. If I'm walking down the street, it's looking up at the sky and appreciating the shape of the clouds, the things we do as kids. There's always time for that, no matter what stage of life we're in.
Bonnie, it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you and congratulations on an absolutely extraordinary feat. Thank you for being my guest on Conversations.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Podcast. Broadcast. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanowski.
Bonnie Hancock was my guest and her book about circumnavigating the Australian coastline is called The Girl Who Touched the Stars. This story was made on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal peoples. The producer was Maggie Morris and the executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.